morning, everyone, once again. A brand new week has started, and this week is not like any other of this year, of the epic 2016, which, as you know, I really think is 2012. That's a whole other show. We'll go through the Mayan calendar, we'll go through the celestial alignments, we'll go through why this is 2012, and all the Mayan anticipation, as I said 4 years ago, should really be saved for this year. By the end of this year, good God, are you going to see amazing things, just astonishing things. In fact, we're seeing some, well, we've seen a lot, and there's good stuff and there's horrible stuff. And my issue for tonight was how to connect the stuff that's going on now with the stuff that went on thousands and thousands of years ago, and to show, back to the Burkean stuff, the connections. Well, we're going to kind of grapple with that tonight. First of all, if you go to theothersideofmidnight.com and click on Radio with Pictures, you will see, if you go to Radio with Pictures, clicked on that, and that takes you to my page, to the guest page. That information at the top is very important, because tonight there is a deputy sheriff lying in a hospital in Baton Rouge who is fighting for his life after that horrible attack a couple of days ago. And as soon as we get his name, they have not released his name, so what I wanted to do tonight, we cannot do, because I want to do the same thing with this individual, this hero, because he got really badly shot in the line of fire, doing his job, protecting his citizens, like all cops are supposed to do. And there's an awful lot of heroes in this story in the last few days. Anyway, he was shot, and they don't release, I guess, the names of those wounded until they... there's some kind of protocol. So we were told this afternoon, or M was told, that tomorrow they'll be releasing the names. So what I want to do tomorrow, which of course is our 40th anniversary Viking panel with some surprises, I want us to do the same thing with this brave soul that we've done with Jimmy Carter. And again, there aren't enough of us to make a difference in ourselves. But remember what Dean Radin has said. It isn't the number, it's the attention. And the whole world, because of, you know, social media, the international, you know, media of broadcast all over the planet, everyone's aware of this incident, of this crisis, of this problem, of this person's fight for life in that room. So tomorrow night, when we have his name, I'm going to do the same thing we did for Jimmy Carter, and hopefully it will make a difference. Now, the reason that's important over and above trying to save this hero's life is because the physics that we'll be using is, in fact, the same physics we're going to talk about tonight regarding the Great Pyramid of Giza. My old friend Chris Dunn, I've known Chris, I don't know, a decade or two, more than that, I think, has done some seminal work we're going to be talking about as we get into the program this morning. And a key part of that has to do with analyzing the Great Pyramid in ancient Egypt, not as a tomb, not as a mausoleum, not as a temple, but as a machine. The only thing that Chris and I differ on, and we have never discussed this, the first time we're going to do this live, you know, around the world. We're in, by the way, I think tonight, 140 countries, I think. M can check, and if I'm wrong, she will correct me. I haven't had a chance to check my widget. I mean, just the idea that we're broadcasting in, you know, almost three quarters, if not more, of the UN is staggering. And an awful lot of those people in all those countries have ancient artifacts, ancient sites, remnants of ancient civilizations. If scientific efforts and focus had been on their ruins, on their ancient history, would we be living on a different planet tonight than we currently are? We're going to grapple with all of this when we come back. You're on the other side of midnight. My name is Richard C. Hoagland, and as you know, we shall return. And we are back on the other side of midnight, on the night of an incredible, gorgeous full moon here in the Land of Enchantment, which, of course, I can't see now because we've got cloud cover. We have humidity. We don't know about humidity here in the Land of Enchantment. So, Patrick, tomorrow it's going to be humid and very warm with a full moon. Okay, puberty has a way of changing a young man. In Chris Dunn's case, it distracted his fervent intentions of being a Catholic priest and led him to the dark side of hedonistic pursuits, which included a fascination for English pubs and performing in Gilbert and Sullivan operettas. Oh, how awful. Of course, appearing in both venues was usually with some very attractive females, so the whole ensemble became a potent force that redirected his ambitions towards something a bit more useful. But the winds of change blew him into a different course, and in 1969, at the age of 23, he was America-bound, where he was to apply his practical engineering skills in the aerospace industry. Fueling his public profile that is commonly known today is decades of experience in aerospace manufacturing, along with a personal path that included community involvement with several organizations, serving on the board of organizations like the YMCA, the Engineers Club, United Way, and Danville Light Opera. It's not like he thought Gilbert and Sullivan, was with him, but it seems that he couldn't get away from it. At this stage in his life, he felt blessed to have followed the path that he had, to have met a wide variety of people that he's met, and to be able to reach out to thousands and even millions around the world, like tonight, 140 countries. Chris Dunn has an extensive background as a craftsman, starting his career as an indentured apprentice in his hometown of Manchester, England, and then recruited by an aerospace manufacturing company. He immigrated to the United States in 69, and over the past 49 years, oh, that magic 49, Chris has worked at every level of high-tech manufacturing, from machinist to toolmaker to programmer and operator of high-powered industrial lasers, project engineer and laser operations manager, and for the past 16 years, he has served as human resource director for a Midwest aerospace manufacturer who, I guess, wishes to remain in the background. Chris's Pyramid Odyssey, which we're going to talk about tonight in some length, began in 1977 when he read Peter Tompkins' seminal book, Secrets of the Great Pyramid. His immediate reaction from learning of the Great Pyramid's precision and design characteristics was to consider that this edifice might have had an original purpose that differed from conventional opinion. After further research and study of source material on various pyramid theories, Chris concluded that it must have originally been built to provide a highly technical society with energy. In short, it was a very large machine. Discovering the purpose of this machine and documenting his case has taken the better part of 20 years of research and following the 1998 publication of Chris's book, The Giza Power Plant, Technology of Ancient Egypt, which describes a holistic energy device that is harmonically coupled with the earth and its inhabitants. And I first encountered, on a personal note, Chris's work in a very interesting specialized little magazine called Analog. I don't even remember when it was published. It was sometime, well, I guess, around the mid-80s, 84, 85. And that got me so excited because his clarity of research and his clarity of explanation in print, I mean, convinced me in one reading, oh my God, Chris Dunn has found something astonishing. Welcome to the other side of midnight, Chris Dunn.
Oh, thank you, Richard. It's good to be back.
It's good to have you back. Okay, for those who missed our first show, we're on a new network, as I've been saying now, kind of with a great smile on my face. We're in 140 countries. So why don't we assume, Chris, that nobody knows anything, and we start with you looking at Tompkins' work and saying, there's something bigger here.
Well, I think that was the kind of the theme through the whole book. And, you know, I'm not the first to actually question the true origins of the Great Pyramid. But I felt that a lot of the explanations didn't really explain all the evidence that was available. And so it was basically starting out to look at the schematics of the Great Pyramid as they were a machine to see if I could figure out exactly what that machine did.
And when you were writing the article for Analog, which, you know, you may say everybody else is thinking about different theories, but you were the first guy that I saw that had an interesting model that I hadn't really seen before, and B, had actual evidence, astonishing, anomalous evidence that did not belong circa, you know, 5,000-6,000 years ago, that would have been fine, you know, in any machine shop on the planet right now. So what bridged that gap for you? What made you go, oh my God, this is nothing like we've been told?
Yes, that was actually a reference from Tompkins' book. He directed me to William Flinders Petrie's work, who studied the Great Pyramid in the 1880s, and he wrote a book called Pyramids and Temples of Giza. And in that book was a chapter on the mechanical methods of the ancient Egyptians. And so the artifacts that he described indicated that by today's standards, the work that they were doing were almost impossible, such as drilling granite with tubular drills with a feed rate of 100 thousandths per revolution of the drill.
Okay, you got to explain what you just said, okay? Feed rate, 100 thousandths.
Okay. Yes, as a drill turns, it advances into the workpiece.
Okay.
And that advancement of the drill is known as a feed rate, how fast or how the distance that it travels as it's rotating into the work.
Oh, you mean it's like the hot knife through butter comparison?
Yeah, well, yes, a little different... a little different action as far as the tool goes, but yeah, similar. And basically, it's like you have a drill that is turning and advancing into the granite at a feed rate of 100 thousandths per revolution. So for every revolution the drill makes, it sinks into the granite 100 thousandths of an inch.
Hmm. And granite is one of the, if not the most hard, natural occurring mineral we know, right?
Yes, it's an igneous rock, and the hardest constituents of the granite is quartz, and that's about 7 on the Mohs scale. And so it's close to the hardness of diamond.
Wow.
Diamond being a 10.
Okay, let me stop you there, because the standard Egyptology that I had read up to reading your piece, which is what made your piece in Analog so astonishing, is that the best tools the ancient Egyptians had were copper, you know, chisels, wooden mallets, stones that they would use to basically pound other stones. Maybe they used fire to crack, you know, use heat and coal to crack rock out of the bedrock. I mean, there are some examples of, I think, obelisks still in place where we can see how they were working to remove the workpiece from the actual bedrock. But your article, your analysis showed that nothing like those primitive techniques could have produced the evidence that you could hold in your hand.
No, that's exactly right. It's impossible. And Egyptologists have tried to replicate that method, but the results fall short of actually indicating the same characteristics that you find on the original work. So, I did myself an experiment using the methods that the Egyptologists describe, and there's a lot more to it than meets the eye.
All right, let me interrupt and ask you this question. We've had, 100 years of Egyptology?
Yeah.
More or less?
Yeah, over 100 years, yeah.
Given that, particularly in England, where the Industrial Revolution was born, we had some really amazing Egyptologists. You mentioned Petrie, there's Smith, there's a few others. How come the Egyptology guys never got together with the mechanical engineering guys, even in the 19th century, to see if their theories had any reality in fact?
Well, they did. Petrie did consult with engineers.
Oh, okay. So
and those working inquiries and actually showed them the artifact that he brought back from Egypt, which is a granite core.
Okay.
That was knocked out of the hole, and he brought that back to England. It's now housed in the Petrie Museum in London, and they tried to puzzle out how it was done. And he kept on coming back to that particular artifact because he was stumped as to how it was possible to achieve those features on this particular core.
Hmm. So if they basically told him that this wasn't primitive, this was really kind of cool and interesting and advanced, how come that never became the mindset of Egyptologists? How come we're stuck with, you know, copper chisels and wooden mallets, et cetera, et cetera?
Well, Petrie was he was a surveyor. His father was an engineer, so he was a technical type. He'd had a technical background. Most Egyptologists today, they don't go for a science degree. They go for an arts degree before they get their doctorate in Egyptology. So, and even in his time, he was fairly unpopular with his contemporaries, particularly in the the Royal Society, and they challenged him, and after he passed away, his work died, and even now, they tried to argue that his observations were incorrect. And so that's the battle that I've been fighting for the last 30 years, is actually trying to prove that Petrie was right, which was, I think I proved that case in my second book, Lost Technologies of Ancient Egypt. But the arguments were that, well, the grooves were not spiral, which is, you know, a reference to the feed rate of the drill.
Right.
They're not helical or spiral down the length of the core, that they're horizontal. And so
Hang on. So yeah. That was where they said Petrie was wrong.
Yeah, I mean, they argued with him.
But if you have an artifact and it's mm-hmm. got grooves, why right. can't you measure what's called the pitch angle of the spiral down the outside of the core?
Well, that's what I did.
But why didn't they?
Petrie did.
Yeah, but why wasn't he believed? I mean, numbers are numbers are numbers. Why couldn't they replicate?
These are modern-day armchair theorists who are uncomfortable with the proposal that I made in that article, that they were using advanced machining in order to create these particular artifacts.
Well, the thing that struck me in that article was you demonstrated that because this spiral groove around, is it a groove or a ridge? I forget.
It's a groove.
Mm-hmm. Which is basically the imprint of the drill after the core is popped out, that angle showed that the descent rate, or as you say, the feed rate, as I call it, the hot knife through butter rate, was astonishing for an incredibly hard material. In fact, I think you noticed that the rate seemed to increase when the drill encountered like quartz or even harder materials, which was totally non-intuitive and implied an extraordinary science of, I believe you thought, ultrasonics, some kind of an ultrasonic drill.
I did propose that in that article, and it wasn't that the feed rate increased at that point, but the depth of the groove increased.
Ah, okay.
Right, and so...
It's only been 30 years, 40 years since I read
that. No, no, that's okay. It's been that long since I wrote it, so... but yeah, it's actually what I concluded tentatively was that the vibration of the drill found sympathetic partners through the granite, and that was the silicon quartz crystal.
Okay. So it's basically the resonance that increased the cutting rate.
Yes, exactly.
Okay. Right. So contrast now the standard Egyptological machining understanding of how to build a pyramid with what you found. In other words, their methods are crude. You found evidence of astonishingly sophisticated artifacts and technology, and never the twain shall meet. So describe some of the precision and how that led you further and further away from the standard Egypt model.
Well, I mean, it's not just that particular. That is a smoking gun. I like to call it a smoking gun because it can't be explained.
Oh, it was to me. It was like ding, right. Ding, 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 ding. My God, how did anybody not notice this?
Yeah, and other artifacts that Petrie described, but the real smoking guns that blew me away was after I visited Egypt and took some measurements. So I went in 1986, and I noticed that a lot of the granite blocks around the pyramids seemed to be extraordinarily precise and regular. But unfortunately, on that visit, I didn't have any tools with me to actually confirm whether they were precise or not. Just a visual on the blocks.
Now, are you talking about things like very sharp right angles and very smooth surfaces, things like that?
Yes, that and even contoured blocks that appeared to have extraordinary precision to them also. So in 1995, I went with a straight edge and some forming wax and also...
Okay, hang on. What's a straight edge? What's a straight edge?
Well, it's a simple piece of steel. About my straight edge is 12 inches long, and it has an edge that is ground on a grinding machine, and the precision on the blade is within 1/10,000th of an inch.
Ah, I used to have some folks at the museum I worked for in Springfield at the Arsenal up the street, and when I quoted some number about 1/10,000th, the guy said, "Well, that's close enough for government work."
Yes. Well, some government work, it probably wouldn't be close enough. I mean, I've done some government work where they wanted 20 millionths of an inch tall. Mm.
Well, that's optical guys. But this was a guy from the Arsenal, so he was designing guns and cannons and shells, and 1/10,000th was their standard, you know. But the idea that modern 20th century precision is found by Chris Dunn in ancient Egypt 5,000 years ago, where the only tools they're supposed to have is copper chisels and wooden mallets. I mean, that's nuts. Or our theory is wrong. Our model is totally wrong.
It is. It's totally wrong. And, you know, the marks, the marks that were left by machines are still there. People can visit them and check them out. You know, I've had people tell me that they go through the Giza Plateau and they take my book with them and they're actually following my footsteps, just as I followed Petrie's footsteps.
My God, that's like half straight edge will travel.
Yes. And so now you see all kinds of YouTube videos with people with straight edges and, you know, carpenter squares.
Well, this is like crowdsourcing cutting edge frontier archaeology. When the mainstream academics won't touch it with a 20,000 millimeter pole.
No. Even a bent pole, they wouldn't touch it with.
So this was on your second trip, you took your measuring devices. Talk about some of the things that you were able to measure and your reaction.
Well, the first one that came as a huge surprise to me was in the second pyramid. And that was in the chamber where they have the so-called sarcophagus.
You mean on the Giza Plateau?
Plateau.
Well, for folks that don't follow us, there's three main big pyramids on the Giza Plateau: the Great Pyramid, the Pyramid of Khafre, and then a slightly smaller one to Mycerinus, who were supposed to be three pharaohs in sequence who each wanted to build big tombs. That's the theory, right?
Right. Father, son, and another son. Mm-hmm. So in this particular box, I jumped down into it with my straight edge, put it up against the inside of the surface, and shone a flashlight between the blade of the straight edge and the inside of the surface of the box. And it was perfect. I mean, I couldn't detect any light coming through.
Oh, my gosh.
And it was so significant, excuse me, so significant to me, I actually yelled out, "Oh, space age precision."
Having an archivist handy to take down any memorable Carter kind of quotes.
Right.
Oh my God, space age precision in ancient Egypt.
Right. And then after that, going to the Serapeum, there are more smoking guns there.
Okay, hang on. We're almost at the bottom of the hour.
Okay.
My guest this morning is Chris Dunn, mechanical engineer par excellence, who was astonished as I was to read of his measurements that there was indeed space age precision in ancient Egypt. Where wonders never cease. You're on the other side of midnight, and we shall return. And we are back on the other side of midnight. So when we left, you were about to go from measuring things on the plateau, the Giza Plateau, to measuring other ancient sites, including a place you call the Serapeum. What is that?
That is a site near Saqqara, near the Step Pyramid,
mm-hmm.
Djoser's Pyramid. And it's a complex that was dug out of the bedrock. So you have these underground tunnels.
You have the pyramid on top, and then you've got tunnels underneath, and I think the whole place is, what, 40 miles from Giza?
It's about 20 miles
20
away.
Miles. Okay.
But there's no pyramid on top. This is a separate site to the Saqqara Pyramid.
Oh, it's not under the enclosure?
No.
Oh,
no.
Okay.
No.
Having never been there, I don't know.
Yeah, well, I had never been there until 1995 either, and so when I went down into the Serapeum, I was even more impressed because there's over 22 very, very large granite boxes. There's one basalt box.
Okay, define a box.
Well, a box, essentially, you have five sides to a box and a lid.
But how big are these
the
boxes?
The size of the box is 13 and a half feet long, about 7.5 feet wide, and about 8-9 feet tall.
So they're more like coffins. When you say box, I think it was square. We're talking a rectangle.
Oh. Yeah, a rectangular, okay. What they call a sarcophagus.
Now, the mainstream Egyptologists claim that these are coffins for sacred bulls, right?
Yes, yeah, the Apis bull. They found an Apis bull or a mummy of a bull inside a wooden coffin inside the Serapeum. But these boxes, they were opened and there was nothing inside them. So they are a complete mystery.
And how many are there?
There are about over 22 of them. And they weigh a finished. I mean, they're cut out of a solid piece. Must have been an enormous amount of work, and they're finished on the inside to extraordinary precision with a very square corners.
Did they have lids?
They had lids, yeah.
Oh, my gosh. Now,
and the lids weigh 20 tons.
That's what, a third of a locomotive?
Well, yeah, granite's pretty heavy.
Oh, my God. So you've got these huge rectangular coffin/boxes, 20 of them, and you go down and jump into one, and you start measuring the inner angles.
Yes, right, exactly. The surface features the flatness of the wall on the inside, and you have a condition where even the squareness between the the inside wall of this box and the lid is perfectly square.
I mean, perfectly to within what, 1/10,000th?
Well, that's the thing. You see, it's not really a quantitative measure for a toolmaker with a square. In order to have a quantitative measure, you would actually, you know, have some feeler gauges to see if you know, you could actually measure something. But it's just a visual thing.
Okay. Well, I mean, if you measure one wall and you can't see any light, and you've got a flat edge, and then you put it on the other wall and you can't see any light, either at the end, that pretty much says it's got to be very, very, very close to 90 degrees, doesn't it?
Yeah, and 90 degrees on both sides. So you have opposing surfaces. So you got one side of the inside, and then you got another surface opposite it with the same condition, which means those two surfaces have to be perfectly parallel.
Okay, now, we're talking coffins, what you said, 13 feet long, 8 feet high, 7 feet wide. The surface area of that is what? 100 square feet, 200, something like that?
I didn't do the calculation, but yeah, I'd say about that.
So we're talking space-age precision 5,000 years ago in a bunch of rectangular coffins slash boxes underground that supposedly are being created to hold dead bulls. Why the precision?
Well, that's my question. Because and essentially, I have to discard the theory that they were cut for bulls.
Okay.
I have to ask the question: When did the ancient Egyptians introduce the bull? And maybe they didn't. Maybe it was just the Egyptologists that introduced it.
Interesting. So you're down there measuring stuff. Obviously, you know, like a kid in a candy store. What else did you find?
Good description. Well, the corners had very, very small radii. I'd say about 5/32 of an inch.
When you say radii, you mean the sharpness of the that corner.
The corner radius, yeah. Mm. Where you had 7/32 of an inch, where one surface meets a perpendicular surface, and then there's a radius in the corner.
So we're talking space-age precision on a scale of hundreds of square feet for one of these boxes at a time when nobody on this planet should have been able to do anything like that, certainly with copper chisels and wooden mallets and what, emery's, you know, kind of rouge and polish and that kind of thing.
Right, right. I mean, you asked the question, why the precision? And really, that kind of precision is a... It doesn't happen by accident. It can't happen by accident. It's very deliberate, and it's so prolific throughout the whole country. even, you know, the obelisks in the south of Egypt, they're perfectly flat too. So, you know, you just go anywhere in Egypt and lay a straight edge on what appears to be a flat surface, and bingo, you've got a high order of precision that really shouldn't be there.
What I can't understand, and I'm going to play, you know, naive, you did this the first thing in 84. Then you went there in 95 and you went again and you published, you've got books, you've been obviously the internet and YouTube and all this stuff. I haven't heard word one from Mark Lehner or Zahi Hawass or any of the big Egyptian guys to say, wait a minute, Chris is on it. This, how did this really happen and why did it happen? In other words, the mainstream academic Egyptological community seems as impermeable as granite itself to a new idea or new evidence.
Yeah, so especially when it comes out outside the field, and especially when it is a something so fantastic, because really it is almost too incredible to believe. But for an engineer, all they have to do is go over there and do their own measurements and satisfy themselves.
So how come this knowledge has not gone viral?
Well, I was hoping it would, actually, Richard. I mean, when I went to Egypt in 86, I took a copy of my article from Analog and and went to talk to an Egyptologist at the Cairo Museum.
Hmm.
And I handed him the article. He looked at the title, shrugged his shoulder, opened a drawer, threw it in there, and dismissed me.
Oh.
So yeah, I mean, it's not important to them.
Well, it's almost like they don't really want to know. They basically want to write papers and make money and retire and have chairs named after them. And it's like their career is separate from finding out.
Well, that's it. But you know, there is hope on the horizon, though.
Oh, I love that. What's the hope?
Yeah, the hope. Well, I've always thought that the Egyptians themselves should actually take up this research and conduct it themselves. And my book, the second book, Lost Technologies of Ancient Egypt, is now going to be translated into Arabic, and it should be published at the end of this year.
Oh my God, that is amazingly good news.
It is, isn't it? And
yeah.
And so there is a following in Egypt, and they are waking up to what they have. So there are alternate voices speaking in Egypt against the establishment.
I can just see this horde of eager Egyptians, all armed with straight edges, galloping toward the pyramids and the great, you know.
Well, okay. I would hope that they would employ more sophisticated instruments. But they certainly are available, you know. I mean, they could use laser alignment interferometers and all you know, different kind of...
Well, wait. That raises another question.
Yeah.
If you've only used techniques and technology that measures to like 1/10,000, is it possible that the precision that's there is much greater and you didn't have the sophisticated equipment to even measure that level of precision?
Well, you know, it's possible, but I doubt it.
But you don't know.
Until
like you mentioned, laser interferometry. Wouldn't it be
right? And the limits of my equipment are, I mean, it's a significant find, even over a 12-inch length, to find that kind.
Oh my God!
Of,
yes.
But over 13 feet, we don't know. You know, and it will require more sophisticated equipment to actually get a full surface map of the inside of the boxes.
Now, the good news is that equipment is now so small, so portable, so energy efficient, so easy to use, you know, like plug and play, that if you got access, any decent technician/scientist could do those measurements in probably a day or so, right?
Yes. I mean, I think the actual probably cleaning the inside of the box may take a day or so. But the real barriers there are the political barriers, you know, overcoming those and actually getting permissions, which for a guy like me is sometimes almost impossible.
Okay, with a change of regime. And Zahi being kicked out, I don't know where Zahi is these days. Have you found it easier to gain access? Have you tried to gain access to do these measurements?
Well, I've only been there one time since 2013 was the last time I went. So one time since the Arab Spring. Okay. And so when the regime switched over, I was actually conducting a tour, so I really didn't foray into the new regime at the SCA. I stayed away from it.
But go ahead.
But my hope is that the Egyptians themselves, with their political connections, will be able to change the paradigm in their own country, because it's to their benefit that they do.
We have said, kind of over consciously, we've said this, that the reason that they have not instantly adopted this extraordinary new paradigm with the data, with the evidence, with the actual samples, is because they're academics and they're basically in their own little bubble. A more sinister interpretation, Chris, is that something is keeping them from acknowledging this because it's not supposed to be known.
Well, yes. I mean, I don't know. I don't really enter into the conspiracy theories.
But when you see a lot of smart people doing the same dumb thing and not looking at the obvious, and the evidence is obvious, you have to look for other theories, other ideas beyond just stupidity.
Well, stupidity, it may be a bit strong. Ignorance, I think, is probably more the condition of their minds. They don't think in engineering terms. And even in Egypt, engineers don't have the same status in Egypt that they do in the States or in the Western world.
Really? Well, that's interesting.
Right.
Is that a cultural thing or an economic thing?
I think so. I think they're more people like Zahi Hawass, Egyptologists or archaeologists. Writers, artists, they seem to have more standing.
Interesting. Okay, speaking of Zahi, did you bring him this data?
Well, I attempted to.
And thereby hangs a tale, and it's not a bull's tale. So tell us the tale.
Well, in 2001, I was there with Grizzly Adams Productions, and we were they were filming a documentary on the pyramids, and they invited me to participate. And so the first thing that they had to do was make nice with Zahi Hawass. And so we met Zahi at the Sheraton in downtown Cairo in the coffee shop. And Gail Fallon, who was the field producer, was a very charming lady. And of course, Zahi responds very well to good-looking, charming ladies.
Gosh, you've noticed that too, huh?
Well, I don't know anybody that hasn't. So, I mean, don't you?
Well, particularly if they tell me that I'm handsome and that I know everything, and they actually tell that to Zahi a lot, apparently. So,
yes. Well, he. But anyway. They were conducting their business meeting. They had the film crew who actually came from Israel, and Zahi was sat next to me, and he turns to me and he said, "What are you doing?"
Did he know who you were?
No.
Oh, he had no idea that who you. Okay.
And I said,
"So
well,
he just kind of showed up because they're television cameras. I mean, it's got moths to flames. He sees a television camera. Zahi's there."
Right, and I said, "Well, I'm an engineer, and I'm here to discuss and admire, the tremendous accomplishments of your ancestors, Dr. Hawass."
Mm-hmm.
And I go, "Okay." Anyway,
that was it.
Oh no, he was interviewed, and we went to his office afterwards, and he received his stipend and. And then we got permission to go into the pyramid, which was closed at the time, and also the Serapeum, where I took more measurements.
Did he evidence any interest in the science in your measurements?
No.
That's very intriguing.
No.
Why wouldn't he?
Well, for one, he's very rigid, and he's also very protective of his own narrative. In other words, he's building his legacy, or he was. It kind of soured a little bit, but and so he wanted to be up front, and the authority on all things Egyptian, when it came to the antiquities. And so that's pretty much how that was his modus operandi. Anybody that came up from outside the field, and I've seen the way he's treated other alternate researchers like Graham Hancock and Robert Pavel. He's very dismissive and rejects everything that is new and novel.
Did I ever tell you this story that in El Aram, which is the major Egyptian, it's kind of like the Washington Post for Washington, except this is in Cairo, there was an article by him where he threatened to cut Babal's head off and mine if I ever came to Egypt? Did you see that? Did you read that?
I didn't know it was your head that was on the black.
As well, yes, as Robert's, right.
Oh, wow, okay. Well, you're in great company there, aren't you, Richard?
Well, as Mark Twain said about being ridden out of town on a rail after being tarred and feathered, if it weren't for the honor of the thing, I'd just as soon pass it up.
Well, I passed up actually poking that bear. I figured that I didn't want to be barred from the plateau or become persona non grata because I had a lot of work to do.
So you didn't really want to press the point because of
politics. No. Okay. There was too much research.
Okay.
That I could do without requesting permission to dig here or dig there. You know, I wasn't looking for the Hall of Records or, anything hidden under the
sand. All you want to do is measure the precision of stuff, just basically.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. So, as a tourist and going there and with instruments in my backpack and, normally there was a policeman on a horse or, on a camel.
That's a great picture.
Who would come by and watch me while I worked. And, they were very accommodating.
Okay, did they evidence any curiosity? They were
curious, but I don't think they really understood what I was doing.
This is so interesting because it's like, it's like that classic thing, hiding in plain sight. You've got this extraordinary technology in evidence. Now, you mentioned a moment ago, I want to get to this, that you'd found this precision all over Egypt.
Yes.
Talk about some of the other places because, one swallow does not make a summer, but a country full of astonishing anomalies and nobody's talking about it or writing about it or trying to get tourists to come and pay for it. I mean, that's just kind of anomalous in itself.
Yeah. Well, that's
the anomaly here.
That is the anomaly. That is a real mystery because, they have a narrative now, which is, their explanation is the true mystery. I mean, they say that the ancient Egyptians built the pyramids and then they built the Serapeum, and the civilization lasted for 3,000 years, and they started out with these, doing their work with copper chisels, wooden hammers, and wooden mallets, stone hammers. And they started out using those tools, and then 3,000 years later, they're still using the same tools. So, as an engineer, there's a huge disconnect there because, it seems to be counterintuitive and ridiculous to think that the genius that is expressed in the artifacts themselves couldn't be transferred to the development of better tools.
Okay, hang on, because you as a mechanical engineer see there's this incredible conflict between the gestalt of the art and architecture and the beauty and the form and the symmetries and the elegance compared to the so-called tools that these guys are supposed to have used to create all this incredible glitterati.
Right.
Why wouldn't Egyptologists, who you said start out more like in the arts and, why wouldn't they notice the same disparity and, as curious men of science, say, how the hell do we explain this? Or are they kind of like the walking dead? They've left their curiosity at the door because they don't notice the incredible discontinuity, the jarring, contradiction between the elegance of what was produced and the incredible primitive nature of what they claim produced it.
Exactly. And that kind of leads to the conspiracy theories. Regardless of how you look at it, it doesn't reflect well on the Egyptologists because either they do know, they're not ignorant of this, and they're just ignoring it or hiding it, because they don't want to upset the apple cart, or they're ignorant of engineering matters, and those things don't even enter into their mind. Because, you know, even they talk about tools, mostly about how the objects are cut, but they never even discuss how they were measured. And that requires a different range of instruments to measure these things to assure the precision and the conformity to the design.
But Petrie was kind of like, and I guess he still is, the gold standard. He approached this from a mechanical point of view. I remember he talked one time about the amount of pressure required on drills to have hollowed out the inner, you know, surface of the coffer, the so-called coffer, in the Great Pyramid.
Yeah. Yes, I mean, he actually took surveying tools, and his measurements of the inside of the coffer in Khafre's pyramid, he was using rods and chains. So, you know, his range of instruments were common to his profession, and the instruments that I used were common to my profession. And, you know, I would claim that mine were a lot more accurate.
Well, with good reason, you know.
With good reason. And this is no discredit to him.
Absolutely not. He was at the state of the art for his art, right?
Exactly.
But why didn't his political ideas get infused? Because he brought science as opposed to opinion. He did measurements. He had actual physical evidence. And he's been ignored.
Yes, he was ignored then, and he's ignored now.
Amazing.
But, you know, I think you have to consider the time that he was actually, the period of time when he was doing this research. I mean, this was in the Victorian era. And, of course, chauvinism was a lot stronger then. And racism was a lot stronger then than it is now. So, you know, they go to, you know, these African countries, and they make assumptions on what is there based on what they see, you know, the culture that they see in the area.
I'll tell you what, hold it there. We're at the top of the hour. We'll take a few seconds for a station break in my favorite NBC tones. And we will come back and continue my conversation with my friend and colleague Chris Dunn as we talk about ancient Egypt and space age engineering in a place it shouldn't be. We shall return. And we are back. So, Chris, let's leave the Giza Plateau, figuratively.
Okay.
You found other extraordinary artifacts and precision other places in Egypt. Kind of give us a sampling of how astonishing this totally unacknowledged reality is.
Well, another fine example of a smoking gun is at the Pyramid of Abu Rawash.
Okay, now tell folks where this is and why it's an unusual place to begin with.
Well, the pyramid at Abu Rawash was supposedly built for another of Khufu's sons, Djedefra. I don't think I'm pronouncing that correctly. But his pyramid was built on a hill about 5 miles from Giza down the Alexander Road.
Okay.
And it's going up the hill and actually climbing to the top of the pyramid. In 2006, I spotted a block of granite in the forecourt. And so going down onto the ground and walking up to it, I pulled out my straight edge to see how flat the surface was.
Have straight edge will travel. Sounds like almost like Paladin. You ever watch Paladin?
No.
He had a great show. It was actually, the head writer of Paladin was my old friend Gene Roddenberry of Star Trek. But Paladin's card, he had a business card. He was a gunslinger. And the card he would hand to people is, have gun, will travel.
Oh, right.
So
right.
Chris Dunn, have straight edge, will travel.
Well, anyway, so this block had a finally cut surface, looked like it was machined. So I put my straight edge on it, and it was not flat.
Oh?
It was curved.
Oh?
And the curve actually was a compound curve where another piece had broken off this block of granite. By compound curve, I meant that there was a radius that was actually imprinted on the granite in two axes rather than just one. So whatever cut it was on an angle, which actually gave the radius on two surfaces.
You mean something like a flutes on a chafing dish, where you have curves going in two geometries, two directions simultaneously?
I'm not sure. I wouldn't describe it quite like that.
Okay. We're not talking cylinders or spheres. We're talking combinations of curved surfaces that meld seamlessly into each other, right?
Yes, that's right. It's like if you take a saw blade, a circular saw, right, and you're cutting into a piece of wood, and you've got the blade tilted, right?
Okay.
And essentially what you have is a radius that is cut on an angle to the Cartesian features of the piece of wood. So you have a square piece of wood. You have XYZ axes, and you have a saw blade that cuts into it on an angle, and you come up with a radius that would be seen as a radius when you view it down one axis and also on another axis. So if you're looking at the top of this block of granite, you see a radius, and when you're looking along the length of it, you see a radius.
Okay.
And the radius looking down from the top is where the piece that was attached to it had broken off.
Oh, okay. Okay, yeah. For five half of the hour, hold it there. We'll come back in 3 minutes. You're on the other side of midnight. My guest this morning is my old friend Chris Dunn, and we're looking at something that's impossible, which is space-age precision thousands of years ago, before there was a space age. Or was it? We'll find out when we return. And we are back on the other side of midnight. My guest this morning, Chris Dunn, with a gorgeous full moon over the shining deserts of the Land of Enchantment. Speaking of deserts, you wandered around in this Egyptian desert and you found these other examples. When you found this compound radius set of curves, that instantly took you from rectilinear, as you called it, Euclidean geometry, to something that's a lot more difficult.
Yes. But the real significant thing was the size of the saw.
Okay.
And when you calculate out the radii, the top, when you're looking at it from the top and when you're looking at it from the length of it, it turns out that the radius of the saw would have been about 37 feet in diameter.
Oh, my God.
Well, the diameter of the saw is 37 feet.
And half that would be 16, 17, something like that.
Yeah, I mean, that really opens up.
That's a three-story building.
Yeah, it's a lot of
stuff. So you're saying they had this huge circular metal, it had to be metal, right, with teeth? Or, I mean, how do you saw through this stuff? It's granite. We're not talking people power or camels, right? We're talking some kind of machine that would do this in a reasonable period of time.
Exactly. And actually, when you consider the size of the saw...
A three-story building. Good God.
And that is hard evidence. It's, you know, it's scientific.
Well, you can't fake the curvature in the radii and all that. The numbers are there. They're immutable.
It's not something you can fake.
And again, Zahi is quietly oblivious.
But it does bring the pyramid building into a more manageable perspective in terms of how would we actually build a pyramid today.
Okay, we have a kind of a cliche around here. We say it only takes one white crow to prove all crows aren't black. I think that's an old Apache saying. We found our white crows all over Mars because Mars is studded with artifacts. We'll have to do a show with you some night about what's on Mars, because the artifacts and the machining and the precision of what we're finding in the NASA imagery of the surface from Curiosity is extraordinary. Like what you found is extraordinary, but here's my point: if all of this technology is around and no one's noticed, it means there had to be an infrastructure of comparable complexity, which has totally disappeared.
Exactly.
So where does it go, and why don't we see even a piece or a fragment or a reference? I mean, there are no, as far as I know, Chris. Correct me if I'm wrong. There are no hieroglyphic tablets or tables or documents or text describing how you build a pyramid.
No, there isn't. Not with the complexity that you find in the Great Pyramids, for one. But there's certainly nothing that describes the tools. And, you know, that is not unusual. I mean, we build massive structures today, but we don't, you know, inscribe on the buildings the machines or, you know, a description of the machines that were actually employed in building them.
Okay.
Those machines come to the worksite, do the job, and then they're taken away.
But nothing like the scale of what you found in this one example has ever been found anywhere in Egypt, right?
Right. Well, there are other, I mean, there's other samples of saw marks, particularly on the Giza Plateau.
Okay.
To the east of the pyramid, there's a basalt pavement where you have...
Now, basalt is a black, iron-rich volcanic rock.
Correct. And on the basalt pavement, you see the indications of very large saws being employed there, too.
Oh.
But now, let me introduce another idea. And that is the reason for the boat pits.
You have to describe what they are.
Well, these so-called boat pits are like trenches dug into the bedrock, and they have a curve at the bottom.
These are alongside the Great Pyramid on two sides at right angles to each other, right?
Yes, there are several on the Giza Plateau. And there's one at Abu Rawash, very close to where that block was found. And so I propose that these were not boat pits, but they were saw pits.
Wait! You mean you would suspend the saw on an axle on the top of the ground,
right?
And half of it would be below ground in the pit, mm-hmm. and half of it would be above, and you'd bring your work wear in terms of working on it with the saw as it rotates. Around.
Yeah, you'd have a stage area, or, you know, a surface that the block would slide along and into the saw. But essentially, you know, it's just like a table saw or something like that.
But we're talking something the size of a four. It's actually a four-story building. I you know.
Right.
How did what was it made of? How did it keep from bending? How did it not tip over? And how was it powered?
Well, all these, I mean, for a sophisticated society like ours, all these questions have simple answers. You know, we can replicate that. We could build a saw like that.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the tunnel bore under the English Channel was 10 feet smaller than the saw Abu Rawash. They used a 27-foot tunnel bore.
Now, when you say a saw, we're not talking like a table saw, which is basically a piece of steel with sharp little things on the edge that rotates rapidly and slices through material, right? We're talking something four-story building tall, half of it underground, half of it above, in this slot, which is carved into the plateau itself or into the ground.
Right.
And it could be made of what? And the operative part is where the edge of it meets the material. So it could be, I mean, what would you make something that big of that'd be light enough to turn the scale and the engineering of even that piece of construction is mind-boggling.
Yes, I mean, it's, but the concept is quite simple. I mean, we understand it today. And as far as the area on the saw that has to actually cut through the blocks, obviously that would be less than the full diameter of the saw. So you could have a very substantial superstructure and just have blades on the edges that are doing the cutting.
Right, right. That's what I'm thinking.
Yeah.
So, but if you found examples of more than one, none of the actual hardware, maybe it wasn't hardware, it was, stone itself, who knows, like a huge grinding mill wheel with the stuff on the edge that does the cutting. So we're not talking a metal blade, we're talking a big disc made of something at the edge of which is the cutting material.
Right. I mean, that is a likely scenario, and that would be, that would fit with the way we do it today.
Okay, could that have been powered by 10,000 slaves, that kind of thing?
Well, that's the thing. It's like we have all these artifacts that have the indication of tremendous engineering knowledge and sophistication, but we still don't want to move the ball forward to say, okay, let's assume that they had energy to power these. Let's assume that they had developed electric motors, and who knows what other electric appliances.
Okay, hang on. This is the time to bring you to an aha moment. A couple weeks ago, I had a guest, an amazingly interesting guest named James Brown, no relation to the other James Brown. This James Brown, James Ernest Brown, is a contractor. Mm-hmm. He's a mechanical engineer. He builds stuff. And he got fascinated, like you got fascinated with Egypt. He has done some astonishing work, which is in a book. I don't have it in front of me here. Do I have it in front of me? No, I don't. But the book basically lists artifact after artifact after artifact that over decades he has now cataloged that appear to be the basis, you're not going to believe this, of an electrical technology in ancient Egypt, including capacitors, gold wire, all kinds of ways of storing charge and transferring it and using it in various ways. In other words, and a lot of the artifacts that he, as an engineer, says are part of this model, the Egyptologists have talked about as ceremonial artifacts, their usual throwaway line.
Yeah.
His data confirms that the Egyptians knew about electricity. Ancient Egyptians knew about, and he has all kinds of examples of functioning, including something that is unbelievable, but a full-size, actually many full-size versions of a Faraday cage, coated inside and out with gold, isolated from the ground, not grounded. The pharaohs, the royal family, would get in these things, and they use the electricity for some kind of medical or homeopathic procedures. So if that level of electrical knowledge was available in the ancient Egypt that we know, it's not a step much further to say that the idea of using electricity to create force, motors, that kind of thing. The only problem is we have all these artifacts that James has found, and we have zero artifacts of the extraordinary high technology that you and I are discussing, which raises an interesting question. Are we looking at two different eras of technological development? In other words, was Egypt, as John Anthony West says, a legacy? The Egypt that we have seen, ancient Egypt, is a legacy from a culture much more ancient, which had all this technology, and something very bad happened. It was a bad hair day. The technology all got swept away, leaving only the remains and the artifacts themselves that were produced by the technology that now, like magic, has vanished into history.
Well, I couldn't have said it better myself. In fact, that is exactly my point.
Wow.
And the point I would have liked to have made. Yes, absolutely. And really, when you look at the events in history that show that there were extinction events and cataclysms, and also when you examine some of the artifacts that show this extraordinary precision and the quality of the cuts from this ancient culture, and they have been modified or adopted in later times, and so you see a mixture of very, very precise and difficult work combined with just simple scratches. And so later culture came by and applied their own story to the stones.
And so we have like a pastiche of layers of culture and technology, and it's figuring out which came first, who did what, who was inheriting what, that has been the huge problem that the Egyptologists haven't even begun to crack.
No, exactly. Exactly. And actually, you know, breaking through that barrier and having them look at it in that perspective, that's nigh impossible right now. Eventually, I'm hoping that they'll turn around.
You mean the Egyptians?
Start to look at it that way.
You mean the Egyptians or the archaeological community?
Well, the powers that be in Egypt. I mean, you know, everybody follows the money. So if there's money in research and it doesn't flow.
But Chris, I mean, I don't want to sound, you know, kind of devil's advocate here, but that's my role, I suppose.
Yeah.
If the fix is in, as we have found in so many other areas of discovery, even our own work on the Mars stuff, mm-hmm. if the fix is in that we're not supposed to know this stuff, if there is a glass ceiling, If their apparent ignorance and stupidity is actually because they've been told under no circumstances will you go near this reality, then we need something bigger than a paradigm shift. We need maybe a political revolution.
Yes, and you know that's. I think it's actually bigger than that. It's not just the political revolution, but it's also deeply rooted in religious beliefs, mm-hmm. And so the Egyptology is and you know the study of ancient Egypt is more it's held with religious fervor, and that story is basically based on beliefs, not necessarily, and a little bit of evidence. So the story has already been written. It was written by Western civilizations, handed to the Egyptians, and they bought it.
Interesting. So maybe there will be an indigenous Egyptian revolution that actually wants to know their real heritage.
Yes, yeah.
Wouldn't that be amazing?
But there are cultural forces that are opposed to that. I mean, you know, the fundamental hardline Islamists would be, you know, severely opposed to that.
they would freak out in spades, I presume. Okay, let's go to theothersideofmidnight.com. Let's go to Radio with Pictures, scroll down to Chris's items, and now we're going to tackle probably your most controversial proposal to date, which is that the Great Pyramid was not a tomb. It wasn't an advertisement. It wasn't a kind of a hangout for ancient Egyptians. It was a machine. So take us from number one through the logic that led you, based on a technology that was apparent all over, of incredible sophistication, that was capable of building a machine of this size and dimension and power.
Well, I think first off, just the schematics of the Great Pyramid, it seemed to suggest that it had a machine function.
Okay, so we go to image number one.
Right.
Under your images, okay.
Right.
That's a kind of a plan view, side view of the Great Pyramid.
Yes, that's a side view of the Great Pyramid. And the and essentially what you have are three main chambers, the subterranean chamber, Queen's Chamber, so-called Queen's Chamber, and King's Chamber.
Yeah, these names, by the way, are totally arbitrary because they don't know. There's not a clue as to what they really were used for.
That's right. The conventional story is that the Khufu wanted to be buried underground, and so they built the subterranean chamber, then he changed his mind and built the Queen's Chamber, then he changed his mind again.
So he was the Donald Trump of his era.
And the architects were having a fit, yeah. So, but the characteristics and, you know, the engineering characteristics of this edifice are quite remarkable considering the time when it was built. And, you know, we do talk about conventional timelines where we say 5,000 years ago, but I believe it's much older than that and predates the ancient Egyptians by many thousands of years and was built before the cataclysm. And function before the cataclysm.
Okay, let's talk a bit about scale.
Yeah.
How big is this machine?
Well, it covers 13 acres.
That's the base.
The base covers 13 acres. And some of the remarkable features about it is that the base is flat within 7/8 of an inch over 13 acres.
What?
Except for the a rise in the center where they left the bedrock, probably to save some material. Yes. So the base, as measured on the outside from corner to corner, is within 7/8 of an inch. That's quite remarkable.
Oh, my God, yeah. Now, what about the alignment? Because the stellar alignment of the pyramids on the Giza Plateau, particularly the Great Pyramid, has always been evidence to me of astonishing sophistication.
Well, the alignment of the pyramid to the polar coordinates is within 3 minutes of a degree of true north.
Okay, for people that don't know what that means, 3 minutes of a degree. A degree is 1/360th of a complete circle. Okay.
Right.
3 minutes, there'd be 60 minutes in a... In 1 degree.
In 1 degree.
So yeah. 3 minutes of 60 is an incredible tiny fraction of an error on a structure which is 13 acres in the floor plan.
And 482 feet high.
Oh, my God. Now, here's something you need to know. When I looked at all this precision, and, you know, it's like everybody, every Egyptologist going back to before Petrie, says, you know, the precision is there. Patrick Smith, Smith measured it, and we've measured it. Modern guys have measured it. So the measurements, again, are not in contention, right?
No. I mean, there are minute differences between each researcher that has taken measurements. So there has been a little bit of dispute, but I think Petrie's measurements are probably the most accurate. And those are the ones that are generally used. There have been some that have come later, but he did a more complete survey of the Giza Plateau.
Okay, so it's not aligned. The Great Pyramid is not aligned. This massive, huge thing, 480-some feet tall. It's not aligned exactly with the true north, but within a fraction of a degree, 3 minutes. Okay.
Right.
There was a paper in Science many years ago that talked about geodetic measurements on the plateau and the rotation of the African plate.
Yeah.
And I don't remember the details of the paper, but the upshot was they were trying to use the rotation of the plate as measured by, I don't know, GPS or something, to extrapolate back to whether in the time of the building of the Great Pyramid it would have aligned perfectly. Okay. In other words, the error is not because of mechanical error. It's due to the literal rotation of the African plate in terms of, you know, plate dynamics on a very dynamic surface of the Earth. When you do that calculation, it doesn't work. But I'll tell you what does work when we come back. You're on the other side of midnight. And my guest this morning, Chris Dunn. My name is Richard C. Hoagland, and we shall return. Carlos has got to get me different music. I mean, this is nice, but we need more variety. And we are back. It's so funny because Em just sent me a note. She says, this reminds me of the movie Stargate. And I said instantly without thinking, well, of course, because they basically stole Chris's work. Well, look at what Stargate. The pyramid is a machine. It's even a levitation machine. It's a spacecraft, and it's got a template where it comes down and fits over, and it was built with high technology. In other words, and it's linked to ancient Egypt and all of that. And as we've said on this show countless times, a lot of truth is now being revealed in film that cannot be revealed as truth, because that way you get around the filters, the sensors, the guys trying to keep us down on the farm.
Yeah, I mean, that's definitely a real possibility, because to actually reveal what we know fully about the Great Pyramid and the implications thereof would upset a lot of people's apple cart.
Okay, I'm going to blow your mind now.
Go on.
Remember,
man,
I talked about the paper in Science. It was back in the 1980s, 83, 84, somewhere in that time frame. I can probably find it if I really look. And what they did is they tried to plug into this equation of the error of the alignment of the pyramid from true north. Huh, error. 3 arc minutes. And they looked at their plate tectonics model and the rotation of the African plate. And they say at the end of the paper, unfortunately, the numbers do not coincide. Therefore, the model is not confirmed. And I looked at that and I said, wait a minute. Because if you simply keep running the calculation back in time, bingo, the alignment is perfect at 200,000 years.
Oh.
That's when a whole bunch of other data converges. And that does not mean that the pyramid we see was built then. It means the architect. Remember, the Giza Plateau is an integrated geometric architecture, which totally throws into an ash can that those pyramids were built separately by successive pharaohs. In fact, their bases were defined by ancient architects. And the data says possibly when the plateau was designed, not the current pyramids on it, but the plateau architecture itself, is maybe 200,000 years ago.
That's mind-blowing.
Isn't it? But in 200,000 years, every possible evidence of the tools that would have been used to do anything like that would be totally gone.
Totally gone, yeah.
Notwithstanding the fact that maybe the catastrophe was a whole lot of water, a big wave sloshing over Egypt, which would have wiped everything out and tossed it God knows where in the Indian Ocean.
And large segments of the Earth's plates disappearing.
Now, the other question I would have is, if we ever get access to Egypt, notice I use the we, Chris?
I picked up on that.
Could we find stuff still buried underground that would not have been swept away in the catastrophe? The tools, the technology, the machines, the motors, that kind of thing.
Possibly. You know, there are sites where, you know, like in tunnel boring, they actually leave the machines at the site. They just bore a hole away from the main tunnel, the tunnel they're going to use, and they just retire them right there. Normally I would say that a work site, you know, if you have sophisticated tools, they have, you know, a high value, and they would take them with them. Now, and so that really opens the question, well, perhaps they were taken away from these construction sites. Where would they go? Where would they, you know, what was their destination? And where that location is, my God, the Sahara is a big desert.
I was going to say, I'm envisioning a super parking garage somewhere underground.
But you know, with modern technology, particularly the satellite ranging and detection. I mean, you never know what that's going to reveal in the future. I mean, the sophistication of them, it keeps improving. So who knows? You know, they may develop some technology that will...
There is a gal, I think she's with the University of Alabama, who has been using satellite imagery, commercial satellite imagery, to do multispectral analysis of the deserts, and she's found, you know, what looks like heat signatures of ancient pyramids and all that. I don't know how much more she's got that we haven't seen yet, but if there was some major complex where the technology was stored until you needed it, because it sounds to me like you wouldn't build a lot of four-story saws, you'd probably make two or three of them and then just break them down and move them.
Well, yes, go from site to site, job to job. Yeah,
okay.
Depending.
Let's get back, because we don't have a lot of time. Let's get back to the Giza Plateau, the Great Pyramid, and your model that, in fact, when the basis of all this incredible engineering evidence, this damn thing was not a tomb, it was a machine.
Right. And if we go to the just the concept of a machine, the Great Pyramid on a scale of acres has the precision of a machine. Just the descending passage over 150 feet of the constructed portion is aligned within the thickness of a thumbnail. That's 20,000ths of an inch. So that's an incredible precision just for that particular passageway. But the interior features and...
So we need to go back to radio with pictures, and I guess we're going to look now at graphic number 2.
Yep, can do.
Okay.
So the original model, or the conventional model, is that you have the King's Chamber, the Antechamber, Grand Gallery, and all the other features. In the Giza Power Plant model, the assignments that I give them is that the subterranean chamber is still the subterranean chamber, but the function of it, it did have a particular function. And essentially, that's where the pyramid was driven to resonance through imparting a resonant frequency through the bedrock into the Great Pyramid.
Okay.
And to actually describe it as I describe it in the Giza power plant, I describe it as a geomechanical power plant and a coupled oscillator. So the coupled oscillator concept, it's actually a scientific principle. A coupled oscillator is coupled with a larger vibrating body, and as long as that larger body will vibrate, continues to vibrate, then the oscillator will draw energy from it.
Okay. So the pyramid in this model would be the oscillator, and the big thing that's vibrating, that's attached to, is the Earth.
Exactly. And so the the energy of the Earth is the power source. People always say, well, you know, the pyramid creates energy. Well, it doesn't. It transduces energy. It takes energy from the Earth and converts it to electrical energy.
Okay.
And it does that through several systems on the inside. And the systems that feed into it are, you have a reaction chamber, and the reaction chamber is the so-called Queen's Chamber. And this chamber created hydrogen, and you have a two shafts leading into it. They actually didn't connect with the chamber. There was a 5 inches of material that wasn't actually cut out of the... And through the southern shaft, you feed a dilute hydrochloric acid solution, and then the northern shaft, a hydrated zinc chloride solution.
Mm-hmm.
Those two chemicals mix and boil off hydrogen.
Mm-hmm.
Then the hydrogen travels through the horizontal passage to the resonator hall, commonly known as the Grand Gallery. Mm-hmm. So the resonator hall is a structure within the Great Pyramid that is about 187 feet long. It's on a 26.5 degree angle, the height of the hall is 28 feet. Width at the bottom is 82 inches. Width at the top is 42 inches. It has corbelled walls.
Ah, so it narrows. It's almost like almost like a cathedral.
Right, and it has a kind of an acoustic characteristic to it, where the sound generated in that particular space actually is resonates within the king's chamber, or the resonant quartzite chamber, as I describe it.
Okay.
And so because of the evidence within this particular space, you have two ramps on both sides of this resonator hall. The two ramps house 27 slots. So there's 27.
Now, we want to scroll down and look at more of these diagrams. Three is the close-up of the King's Chamber, so-called. Four is a side view of the Grand Gallery. And you've got some kind of mechanical device that you're proposing might have been in there.
Yes. The devices that I propose are resonators that were mounted in the slots that are cut into the ramps on both sides of the gallery.
Okay, what is a Helmholtz resonator?
Well, a Helmholtz resonator is a resonator that actually draws energy from the source. If you have a vibrating source, then the Helmholtz resonator will draw it. I've actually received a correction on that from a physicist who believes that the resonators were not Helmholtz in that they held the acoustic energy, but the King's Chamber or the resonant quartzite chamber, it was the Helmholtz resonator. Functioned as the Helmholtz resonator, and basically, it's almost like it sucked the sound waves into it, and responded very efficiently to the frequencies being generated in the Grand Gallery, and also the frequencies that are actually resonating the granite coming through the pyramid structure.
Okay.
So really, the whole energy conversion is based on harmonics and sound, and the sound that is the signature that has been found within the King's Chamber was discovered by Tom Danley in 1995. He's an acoustics engineer with NASA.
Didn't he work with Boris Said?
That is correct. Yes. Yes.
Because I remember that he got all kinds of weird frequencies that didn't seem to make any... it's been so long since I looked at that data. But in other words, backing off and looking at big, big picture, you think that the Great Pyramid was an acoustic machine designed to harness and amplify the background earthquake vibrations that are constantly going on all over the planet.
Right.
Drawing essentially on an infinite energy of the planet itself,
mm-hmm.
and designed to do something in the so-called King's Chamber, which really is totally misnamed and was the focus of some kind of experimental technology to do what?
Well, the fascinating thing about the King's Chamber is that it's constructed entirely of granite. And all the characteristics of the construction of this particular...
Now, the reason we need to point this out, that the pyramid itself is made of limestone, but these interior architectural refinements and incredibly interior structures are made out of a totally different material, which is rosy or red granite, right?
Rose red granite, yes. And it has 55% silicon quartz crystal.
Wow.
And there are thousands of tons of it. Now, you know, as you know, there are many, many theories about how the pyramid functioned and different ideas and, you know, different spins on the same idea. But, and even, you know, in my book, I always said that I'm always interested in hearing different ideas about, you know, or even improvements on the ideas that I present. But the evidence is fairly, I mean, it's almost solid. It is solid that the structures were built with acoustics in mind, very sophisticated acoustics.
Which is where the precision comes in.
Right. Now, if you look at the power center, which I have a JPEG on that.
Yeah, illustration number 3.
There is a there are 5 layers of granite beams above the King's Chamber. The conventional theory is that they were relieving chambers. They were put there so that the King's Chamber could have a flat ceiling rather than a gable ceiling that we find in the Queen's Chamber. Mm-hmm. However, when you actually analyze it from an engineering perspective, those granite beams are holding up nothing but their own weight. The gable blocks that cover that whole structure at the top are actually withholding the weight of the pyramid above.
Now, wait. How can the Egyptologists, who obviously know people in academia who are mechanical engineers like yourself, how can they have held for over 100 years that those huge 70-ton granite blocks above the King's Chamber are to relieve the stresses when you do the analysis, it's obvious that's wrong?
Right. I mean, that's a good question. How do they? I don't know. Because they have to have answers for everything.
Well, they have to maintain the cover. In other words, the more we get into this, I'm sorry, Chris, you can't have that many bright people be that dumb. Unless there is a conspiracy. Why are we so afraid of the word conspiracy? Why do we have an FBI, a CIA, the NSA, you know, the Justice Department? We're surrounded by conspiracies. That's what crime is. Keeping things secret is a crime, depending upon the political context. So if we're involved in a conspiracy to not let us know what this thing was meant for, it means that it would threaten so much to reveal this level of technological knowledge was antecedent to ours by 5,000 years. Let's go to image number 5, because this is the close-up of what's called the antechamber. And recently, Mark Lehner, in a Discovery Channel thing called, I think, The Unearthed, has a whole theory that this was basically a chamber designed to keep tomb robbers from taking the pharaoh out of the tomb. And I looked at this and I said, are they still, you know, portraying this absurd idea given, again, the precision, and there's close-ups of these grooves and how they're broken off, and the whole thing looks so damn mechanical. Your model is?
Yes, Mark Lehner's new theory is a very old theory.
I know.
That was proposed by Borchardt 100 years ago.
Yeah,
I don't know how long. But it's a very old theory, and it's along the lines that the pyramid is a tomb. But when you're dealing with acoustics, my sense was that they had actually maximized or tuned the input into the King's Chamber to maximize the reverberation.
Oh, wait, you mean these so-called portcullises? And it took me, I don't know, when I started reading about Egypt, you know, I ran across this word portcullis.
Right.
It took me, there was no Google back then, so you had to actually go to a dictionary, and didn't have a dictionary. Like the dictionaries didn't normally cover portcullis. It turns out these are basically just sliding slabs that can be raised or lowered, and if you raised and lowered them in your theory, you would change the tuning, like a super saxophone of the pyramid resonance.
Exactly. So basically you have a filter, an acoustic filter, and then the ability to tweak it to maximize the throughput.
When you say tweak it, maybe to get the right frequency.
Right, exactly.
So why would you need, in a machine designed to create energy, why would you need, Chris, the right frequency?
Well, because that is actually the resonance, and it's the power. That's where your power is. The frequency is everything. The frequency to actually drive.
Okay, so you basically want what's called a mode lock, where it locks into a resonant, echoey pattern, like singing in the shower.
Exactly, because and the sound is entering a room of specific dimensions that resonate to particular frequencies, and so if you're off, you know, if you don't match those frequencies, then you don't have the maximum power input. But if you match the frequencies, then the granite will resonate and absorb those frequencies more efficiently.
Okay, let's get back to the theory, because we don't have much time. We've got to get to the end of what you think this power plant was designed to do.
Right. Well, I mean, this is a kind of a short précis on the entire theory. So, but essentially, it all has certain features and evidence to back it up. Sure, there may be adjustments and changes, and there already is, but I need to update the Giza power plant and get another book out there with those changes. but so if you go to the other image that shows...
Which number?
I think that would be number...
Five? Is this the color close up of the acoustic
field? No. The Pyramid Mesa.
Well, Pyramid Mesa. Where have we got that? Where?
Oh, I don't.
No, you didn't put it in. We don't have it. Sorry.
Okay. Well, all right. Well, I'll just describe.
I was going to say it's radio. Word pictures. Go for it.
Okay. So in the King's Chamber, you have two shafts that enter, one from the north, one from the south. And these actually do exit to the outside. And so I propose that the northern shaft, you have a microwave signal input. That microwave signal is 21 centimeters, or 8.309 inches. And essentially, it is matched with the waveguide, or I call it the waveguide, but a shaft, the shaft itself.
Right. Right.
Which is 8.4 inches wide and 4.8 inches high. So you have the dimensions of hydrogen in the King's Chamber. And then opposite, in the opposite wall, in the south wall, you have what appears to be a microwave horn antenna. It has the features, it's like a catcher's mitt. And that is cut into the south wall. And so the proposal that I give is that the microwaves, which is essentially gathered from the universe, that frequency is striking the planet 24/7.
Well, for people who don't know, the 21-centimeter hydrogen radio signal is called the Interstellar Song of Hydrogen, because there are trillions and trillions and countless trillions of hydrogen atoms floating free in interstellar space, and when they flip their little electrons over, they emit or absorb this 21-centimeter radiation in the microwave region. So the universe is kind of permeated with this ambient wafting cloud of radio energy. This structure would have been designed in your model to basically accentuate and amplify that particular frequency.
Exactly. And so we have the hydrogen coming from the Queen's Chamber. We have the vibration, the acoustic energy. And so essentially it becomes like an acoustic engine.
Okay, we only got 3 minutes left. So 3 minutes left. A, what was the pyramid used for? We got to have you back to go to the next part. What do you think?
There are several proposals.
We don't have time for all of them. So what do you think?
No. Okay. Well, I propose that you could beam the output, microwave output, to a relay satellite through the southern shaft, or you could collect it on the outside of the pyramid.
Okay.
Some people have proposed that it was a beacon. You know, I mean, I have no objection to that either.
Okay. We don't have time. I want to get to CPAC. You're going to be able to see Chris Dunn in person and have what, 2-3 hour exposition of all this on September 30th to October 2nd in Rancho Mirage, California, the CPAC 2016 conference. Tell everybody how to get tickets, how to find you, and how to connect with you at the conference.
Well, the yes, people can go to www.cpac.com.
Online.com.
That's CPAK, online.com.
And this is all on your page tonight, so people can check your page here on Other Side of Midnight.
Right. And then, you know, just input the code DUNN, which is remarkably similar to my last name.
It really is very striking.
And they will get a 20%
discount. Variability error. Okay.
So there you go. I'm looking forward to that. I mean, Robert Schock is going to be talking, John Anthony West.
Oh, my God, yeah. Carmen Boulder, she's been here. Gary Evans, a lot of interesting. And Walter Cruttendon. By the way, tell Walter I would love to have him on the show. I want to talk about his binary star model.
Oh, I'm sure he'd love to come on and talk to you.
Okay, well, please pass the word and tell him that M will be after him. And, hey, look, we got to have you back because we, again, have just scratched the surface. There's another model I wanted to run by you.
Well, I want to hear it.
And unfortunately, we don't have time tonight because our music's playing. It's the end of the show.
Oh, my God. Okay.
Well, I want to thank my guest, Chris Dunn, who has got a brilliant theory with all kinds of interesting evidence. And the most important part, he's open to other possibilities congruent with the evidence. Thank you, Chris. We will talk very soon.
My pleasure.
So, everyone, until tomorrow morning, when we do our 40th anniversary of Viking Imaging Panel with surprises. Boy, we got surprises. Remember, third star on the left, straight on till morning. Good night, everyone.